All right. Thank you so much. And welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you, coast to coast, border to border, and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network. We have in studio, and you can see him on the twitch.tv camera, Lincoln Mitchell. He has written many books. The new one now is called San Francisco Year Zero, Political Upheaval, Punk Rock, and a Third Place Baseball Team. This is from Rutgers University Press. And before we went on the air, we were just talking about the sort of the religious dichotomy in Crown Heights and Brooklyn. And that's the thing. You're a San Francisco guy, but you've spent a lot of time in New York. Tell us a little bit more about your very interesting background.
Well, the way I like to explain it is I spent half my life having all my friends out here saying, dude, mellow out. And then the other half having all my friends in New York say, how come nothing seems to stress you out so much? I was born in Manhattan. I moved here shortly before my fourth birthday. I wanted to do something new. My parents moved out here. I came with them.
You had some opportunities.
Yeah, I had some opportunities. You know, it was the 70s. It was a crazy time.
You wanted to sell some pet rocks.
Exactly. A lot of opportunities. So I stayed here through college. The Graduate Department of Political Science at Stanford and Berkeley both agreed upon me not being a good enough candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up going to New York City with the thought of I'd go there to get a degree, et cetera, et cetera. And then my friend Ashley Judd knew two Jews in graduate school at Columbia, figured we'd like each other, and we did. So my wife and I, when she was beginning her career in New York, we've just stayed there the rest of till now. But I'm out here about a month or two every year because – well, my mother still lives here, so unlike a lot of people, I have a free place to stay in San Francisco. And I have a lot of friends, and I'm fascinated by the city's history. And I'm a big Giants fan. I grew up rooting for the Warriors, and for years I'm not a huge basketball fan. That was a good way to end a conversation about basketball. Mm-hmm. Now people are interested in the Warriors, and of course the 49ers are having a good year too. So.
Right. So I think it's funny you said that because, like, being born and raised in the Bay Area, I always thought of myself as more conservative, and then I go to other parts of the country, and I can't believe how liberal I am. I mean, it's like, it's a weird thing.
You know, I now live in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, near where Columbia is, for those of you who know New York, and mm-hmm. I've been there for quite a while, and I remember, and that neighborhood is filled with people, and Manhattan in general, who have that experience kind of in reverse, where they come there and they say, my God, what a liberal place. I moved to the Upper West Side, walked around my first week or two there and said, how did I get in such a right-wing neighborhood? I grew up in San Francisco. I graduated from UC Santa Cruz. So it all kind of depends on where you're coming from.
Right. Was that back when they had no grades?
Yes. It was great. And I was a good student. Like, but actually, as somebody who took school seriously, it was good because, in all seriousness, your conversation with your professor, and now I'm a professor, so I see it from the other side, mm-hmm. was never, why'd I get an A-minus, not an A? It was, what did you think of my paper? So
right.
You got to engage intellectually. Even if you wanted a better narrative evaluation, you had to engage intellectually. It couldn't be as transactional as grades are too frequently.
Right. I remember I took a class at summer school at Cal from Dr. Harry Edwards, and I saw him years later, and I said, hey, Dr. Edwards, I took your class in 1986, and he said, how did you do? And I said, you gave me a B, and he said, I don't give out grades. Students earn them.
I'm like, very good.
I think at Santa Cruz, though, I think it was kids were having problems getting into grad schools because, like, I got pass-fails here. I don't know if you got a C or an A.
Well, at Santa Cruz back then, and I don't know exactly how it works now, although my son is applying, so mm-hmm. maybe he'll know. But back
go then, banana slugs.
Absolutely. It's too bad they don't have a baseball team because then I think he'd be a stronger applicant. But
yes.
They gave you an evaluation, a paragraph or two. Mm-hmm. So if it was a politics course, it would be he wrote his essay about this and that. Here's where the strengths, here are the weaknesses. So almost like a mini recommendation for each school. Now, when I applied to grad school, there was one of the best political science departments in the country, the University of Michigan, simply could not process that application. And
right.
they kept writing me back. This is days before the internet and everything, asking for grades. And I would call them and say, I went to UC. It's not a small school. They don't have grades. That transcript is the grades. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And we went back and forth. And after I'd enrolled at Columbia and begun taking classes there, they sent me a letter rejecting me. So I didn't go. I went to Columbia instead.
Did you was Obama there when you were there?
At Columbia?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Although some of his professors when he was there were people for whom I was a TA, you know, when I was in grad school.
Right. And it's funny. I remember my buddy went to Columbia and he said, and he's from here, he said, I just decided that I would try to out-nice everyone. That's how I was going to attack New York and that neighborhood.
Well, New York is different now, right? The worst thing that happens to you in New York now is your Uber doesn't show up on time. anybody who's like younger than 30 who pulls the I'm tough, I'm from New York, just laugh in their
right.
face. It's not that kind of
well, you
place
look at
anymore.
Like the West. I stayed in the East Village there last year, and you think about how Alphabet City, you couldn't even go in. You can go to like C and you're okay.
Everything. It's, you know, it is I mean, my friends here now, for example, for this book, I did a lot of research at the public library here in San Francisco, and I would ride my bike down because you can't find parking and I need the exercise, and I like riding my bike. And like I said, I mean, I'm in my 50s, but I stay with my mom when I'm in San Francisco.
Sure.
And she would say, "Are you sure you can leave your bike locked up outside there all day?" And no one in New York would say that anymore. You know, if you forget to lock your door here, my San Francisco friends, and these are people who spent their whole lives here. They know the city well. They're like, "Hey, man, you should lock your door." In New York, no one cares anymore. It's really kind of changed, yeah.
Or maybe just on the Upper West Side.
No, I go all over the city. And listen, where I live now—
What are you, 177th Street?
I'm on 105th, but where okay. I am now was, you know, this was— let's say this one. When we first moved in there, we were the gentrifiers. Now my neighbors look down on me because I drive a beat-up Subaru, not a Mercedes. You
know. So how far are you from the GWB then?
On a bike, 20 minutes.
Okay.
On a car, either 10 minutes or 50 minutes, depending on when.
By the way, you can tell from this conversation I'm going to keep you here more than one segment.
However you need me. I'm here for you, man.
We haven't even got to
as
the—
As long as you can get a theme song like that for me, then I'll hear you.
Yeah, well, that's just a little 99-cent app. I can do it. It was right, Clay Aiken and T-Pain did that for
we'll
us.
Work on that.
So you, just to get a taste, we'll get into the book. This book is mostly about 1978.
Yes.
And I remember it well. I was in the eighth grade, and there was a lot of crazy stuff happening here. We had, especially if you're from the East Bay like me, and the whole Jonestown situation in Guyana and the mass suicide. I still to this day won't say I'm drinking the Kool-Aid because I remember how—
'Cause you shouldn't.
No, and people don't— – I don't think people really realize where that— – saying comes right. from.
No, they don't.
People and, be and I just remember the Chronicle, all those dead bodies everywhere, and I think I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. I'm like, I can't say it.
And first of all, it was Flavor Aid, not Kool-Aid.
Oh,
because Jim Jones was so committed to stealing money from poor people that he didn't even spring for the good stuff. But
so they had poisoned Hydrox instead of Oreos.
Exactly. But it's not
joke.
Funny.
I know, but
it's
we're laughing.
At all. It's
dark
also,
humor.
But also, just on a more serious note, it wasn't a mass suicide. It was a mass homicide. And I really make that point in this book. The conventional definition of suicide is not somebody puts a gun to your head and says, drink the poison. That's homicide. Mm-hmm. This was a mass killing. Jones was a mass murderer. He did not lead a mass suicide. So I just want to maybe—
And who was it, Ryan, that went down? We watched
Congressman
him,
Leo Ryan.
Yeah, shot on the runway.
He was shot on the runway. One of the people who survived that shooting was Jackie Spears, now the congresswoman from that district.
Mm-hmm.
And Jones, and I talk about this in the book, you know— the United States government doesn't look kindly on shooting down a member of Congress in cold blood. At least they didn't in 1978. I don't know how. I mean, I think there are people who might take a different position in the Republican Party now, but they didn't. So once Jones did that, he really left himself no recourse. And the time between that and the dead bodies, the piles of bodies that we all saw in those newspapers, was very quick because he that was a bridge he could not uncross.
That was about as shocking as it got. And then I swear, like a fortnight later, we had the situation with Milk and Moscone. And we'll get to that. We're going to take a quick break right here. And when we come back, we have in studio Lincoln Mitchell, the new book, San Francisco Year Zero, Political Upheaval, Punk Rock and a Third Place Baseball Team. We'll talk about the Giants as well and what they did that year. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back. All right, believe it or not, we got some highbrow, sophisticated conversation going on here today because I have in studio with me the first hour, Lincoln A. Mitchell, the book, San Francisco, Year Zero, Political Upheaval, Punk Rock, and a Third Place Baseball Team from Rutgers University Press. So we know, I think a lot of Americans didn't really know about the Harvey Milk and George Moscone killings until the movie Milk came out, which I thought was pretty good. I mean, I lived through it, and I thought it was pretty much as I remembered it, but I'll just put it to you this way. I was at recess at Adams Junior High School in Richmond, California, and this guy comes over and he says, "Guess what? Some gay guy shot Mayor Moscone." And we're like, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, he killed him." We went, "Who did?" "A gay guy." So no internet. This is how news was spreading. And I had never heard of Supervisor Dan White at the time. How about you when you were in the sixth grade? Right?
I was in the sixth grade. I had a little different take on this. So Harvey Milk, my mother, who I'm, you know, I'm staying with now in San Francisco, my mother, she liked Harvey Milk because she had told us that Harvey Milk was one of us. And the reason for that was that Harvey Milk was a left-wing Jew from New York who spoke Yiddish. He spoke with a New York accent. His was stronger than my mother's, but he was one of us in that way. My mother's politics were very left of center, so she was – you know, she wasn't it's not to be dishonest to say she was out there demonstrating for gay rights in the mid-1970s, but she wasn't a homophobe. So he was a progressive Jew from New York. So mm-hmm. were we. I learned about it just after either recess or lunch when the nun, Sister Schroeder, came in and announced they've shot the mayor and Supervisor Harvey Milk, at which point a number of my students, my classmates, applauded.
Whoa.
And said they killed that F word, and I won't repeat it.
Oh, my gosh.
So this was and I talk about this in the book. I was terrified because I've been told Milk was one of us because of – so and the assassinations radically changed San Francisco. And one of the things I talk about in the book a bit is that most of America learned about it through that film, which I think is a very good film. There were some things that in researching this book I think they got a little wrong, but basically a very good film.
Mm-hmm.
But one of – the things that's not the film's fault necessarily is that therefore people learn of Moscone as he's the straight career politician who got murdered along with Harvey Milk. But George Moscone's legacy is much greater than that. George Moscone was a progressive, perhaps even a radical mayor, the first really in San Francisco's history. And there have only been two who were real progressives. The other was Art Agnes. And Moscone was really seeking to make a different San Francisco. And he was unable to in his 3 years as mayor, largely because he didn't have a majority in the Board of Supervisors. And he was about to get that majority when he was assassinated. So the loss of George Moscone and the Dianne Feinstein coming in as mayor, much more of a centrist, much more of a conventional San Francisco politician, although recognizing in the moment two things. One, Dianne Feinstein, regardless of what you think of her now, she's now been in the U.S. Senate for a very long time, regardless of what you think of her now, in those hours and days and weeks after the assassination was extraordinary.
She's the one that told the press, I remember.
She's the one that told the press. She held the city together at a time when it wasn't obvious it was going to be held together. As you pointed out before we went to the break, only 10 days after the mass killing in Jonestown. Mm-hmm. So these two tragedies, what kind of city is this? How are we going to survive? And Dianne Feinstein showed tremendous strength. So she gets credit for that. And the other thing for which she gets credit is that Moscone had radically diversified the leadership of the city. It was no longer just straight white men. And Feinstein understood that there was no going back from that.
You know, it's funny. I think Mayor Moscone was probably the first San Francisco mayor I was aware of. The alliteration is so good to remember his name. But I just remember seeing him on TV. He always had a big smile on his face. And I remember thinking, I don't think I've ever seen a politician who seemed happy all the time. But just as an aside to Feinstein, the thing that I really respect about her is I don't have a lot of time for people who think that the other side is 100% evil. And I remember her saying, I don't want these military bases closed here. It's a part of our tradition, which went against her party. She said, I'll never believe a word Clinton ever says in his life. He lied to my face. A lot of Democrats wouldn't say that. So I respect the fact that she's her own woman. And, you know, we recently had these young kids come in and rouse her about things and act like spoiled. I hate to say spoiled millennials because I don't want to group everyone together. But I do have a lot of I have a lot of respect for her that she just doesn't go along party lines. She thinks for herself.
She's an extraordinary politician, and one of the extraordinary parts of the story is her career was over that Monday morning. She went into City Hall that Monday morning and said, "I'm done. I'm not running for re-election." Which was if you're a legislative leader, you're not running for re-election, you're done. Mm-hmm. She had run for mayor twice. That kind of independent centrism, which appealed to you, is very tough in a three-way election, right? Yeah. In 1975, John Barbagallotti got the right. George Moscone got the left, and there wasn't enough in the middle for her to even make the runoff. So that wasn't that style, which a lot of San Franciscans liked. Remember, she was reelected in 79 and then reelected essentially without opposition in 83. So whatever she was doing was working. Mm-hmm. But it was very hard to break through that first time. And I would argue that even – and I know a lot of people, and I would put myself in this group, that have criticisms of her from the left – but the hybrid that she crafted, the differences that she split, helped the city tremendously. And if, with the exception of Art Agnos, every mayor, down to London Breed, you know, the mayor of San Francisco today, is working on that Feinstein model. We live and die in Feinstein San Francisco. We don't live in George Moscone San Francisco because he was assassinated before he really had a chance to bring it to fruition. He would have been up for re-election in 79, and had he won, it would have been a very different story.
You know, it's funny. When I think about Art Agnos, the first thing I think of as an Oakland A's fan, because I'm an East Bay guy, was that Mayor Lionel Wilson in Oakland for the 89 World Series said, hey, let's do a city bet. You know, if you win, you got to give me clam chowder and some crab from Fisherman's Wharf. What do you want? And Art Agnos said, there's nothing in Oakland that I want. very smugly. And so at the World Series party, Mark McGwire held up the trophy and said, "Hey, Art, do you want this?" That's like the first thing I think of. But, you know, you sat down and interviewed him for this book. What did you find out, things you didn't know about from that interview?
I'll tell you a great story about Art Agnos that he told me. And Agnos is he's from Springfield, Massachusetts, which is in Massachusetts somewhere, doesn't matter. But the Giants had a farm team there. So Agnos comes to rooting for the Giants before they were even in San Francisco. And this was, you know, so among the players passing through were people like Willie McCovey, who went on to, you know, to great stardom, and the late Willie McCovey, and probably most beloved San Francisco Giant of all, maybe. But he told me that his favorite Giant was Felipe Alou. And I said, now, Felipe Alou, in my view, was a great player. I think you can make a Hall of Fame case for the entire oeuvre of his work. That's not why Art Agnos was so drawn to him. But he said, Art Agnos grew up, he was the son of an immigrant, didn't have any money growing up, and his father owned a shoe shine stand.
Mm-hmm.
And Agnos helped out his father by shining the shoes. But like I said, they didn't have a lot of money. So the deal they had was that his father got the pay, it was 20 cents, 15 cents for the shoe shine, and Agnos got the tip. And the best tipper, Felipe Alou.
That is a great story, especially I like those rags to riches type of stories. You also
One more thing about Agnos.
Yeah.
Rags to riches doesn't quite capture it. Agnos has stayed the progressive that he's always been. He's not someone who cashed it in and went and made a lot of money somewhere.
What does he do now?
Now he's older. He's in his 80s. Mm-hmm. He's in his 80s. He kind of works, but not – I mean, like, helps out progressive causes in San Francisco and does speaking engagements. He's a good guy who's always stuck to his principles.
What would you say, taking a step back, was the best thing he did for the city and then the thing that he got wrong?
The best thing Agnos did was bring the city together after the earthquake. Now, I would say that October of 1989 is a month like November of 1978.
I was at Candlestick when that went down.
I couldn't get tickets, but I was in Game 5 of the NLCS when they won the pennant, and that was good enough
Mitch
for me.
Williams,
that
sure.
That was great, that Will Clark single.
Yeah.
So it was a seminal month. It really formed modern San Francisco, and the way he held the city together after the earthquake. But that earthquake also destroyed his mayoralty in that if that earthquake doesn't happen, I think the ballpark initiative passes. And the ballpark initiative, then...
Was that the China Basin one or the one that was out by the railroad tracks?
It was the China Basin one. It's the one that essentially is the model for what we have now, right? Had that passed, he would have been reelected. The defeat of that ballpark initiative, which was many of the people opposing it, saw it as a dry run for taking out Art Agnos. They saw it as a dress rehearsal for that. So that brought down his mayoralty. But I don't think he got it wrong there. I think he couldn't have predicted an earthquake. I think what Agnos got wrong is... that in a city, you know, and I think in this regard, San Francisco is like New York. It's much smaller, but there's a tremendous amount of here. If you read the local media, and particularly in those days, you know, different technology, there's a tremendous amount of coverage of City Hall and of what's happening in Washington. And Sacramento is a place that people don't really want to go and hang out, so they don't cover it. Similar to Albany, Sacramento's nicer than Albany, but it's not San Francisco. And therefore, the job is a person-to-person job, whether it's person-to-reporter out in the neighborhoods. And Agnos, I don't think he got that wrong, but in a tough, still divided city, he didn't do it well enough. To contrast that to George Moscone. George Moscone, his progressive politics turned off some people, but he was an old San Francisco guy who knew everybody, as you pointed out, was always smiling, a star athlete, and he could bridge that and bring people
had
together.
Had the Italian thing going.
The Italian-American, you know, it's just a bigger constituency. Greek-American can raise a lot of money, but it's often outside of the city. So I think those were just, they're very similar mayors. Moscone had more political skills. And that doesn't say Agnos didn't. Agnos, very successful politician, but lost one election.
I was trying to explain to somebody about what a unique town this is politically, that in a mayoral election, you had Willie Brown, who was one of the most liberals in Sacramento. He comes down. He's considered the conservative because he's running against Tom Amiano, who's a gay stand-up comedian. And I thought, I don't think Willie Brown ever in his life would think that he would be the conservative on the ballot.
Well, or to go back to Dianne Feinstein, right? In the 1980s, when you left San Francisco, Dianne Feinstein was seen as among people, just not people who were deeply involved in politics, but people who paid a little bit of attention, the kind of left-wing Jewish woman who was mayor of San Francisco. And here she was considered the conservative.
Yeah, there's Margaret Thatcher here.
Right, exactly. And among the punks, for whom she always had a special animus, they really did hate her. Mm. And she might as well have been Margaret Thatcher. I don't think that's a fair comparison for Dianne Feinstein.
Yeah. There were no Falklands wars going on at that point.
No, and she didn't say things like there is no such thing as society. I mean, Thatcher was really kind of out there.
No doubt. The Iron Lady, Iron Maiden, whichever one you want, whatever band you would like. When we come back, we'll talk about bands, and we'll also talk about the San Francisco Giants, who started to stir in 1978 as well. We're speaking, of course, with Lincoln Mitchell. The new book San Francisco Year Zero, Political Upheaval, Punk Rock, and a third-place baseball team. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back. All right, back with you. Thanks for tuning in. Whatever you've got going on, the number to call, 800-878-PLAY. Of course, the Twitter, at Rick Tittle. And shout-out to the troops listening on AFN, having a very interesting discussion with another local here, Lincoln Mitchell. His book, San Francisco Year Zero, Political Upheaval, Punk Rock, and a third-place baseball team. Punk rock. Now, I was a huge punk rock kid. I didn't have a mohawk, and I didn't believe in anarchy, but I sure did love the music. I loved going to the shows here in the city, the old Keystone, the Mabui Gardens, and all that. It's still probably my favorite type of music. It's just always has been. How did that area come into this book?
Well, I wanted to write about that area for a couple of reasons. One, San Francisco. One of the things that defined San Francisco in 1978 was the extended hangover from the Summer of Love. But if you're, you know, roughly our age, and we're the same age, we were kids back then in middle school, the Summer of Love, the hippie was the substitute teacher, the bus driver, the person doing the after-school arts and craft program, the lower school teacher. They were the kind of mid-level authority figures. They weren't radical to us anymore, and they weren't radical to the punks anymore. And out of that milieu comes punk rock. And punk rock in 19 really starts in 77, 78 here. The Sex Pistols play their last concert ever in January of 1978 in San Francisco. So that's kind of a turning point.
Is that Winterland?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Punk then, which was a Bill Graham concert, where he, for the first time, put a number of punk bands on the stage because he hadn't liked punk. And the reason for that, I think, is a rather obvious one, that if you use a lot of swastikas, even if you claim it's ironic, the guy who spent his youth trying to evade Hitler, he may not want to give you an opportunity to perform. And I think, you know, maybe we should take a step back and think about why, right? But in any case, so it's this turning point in the culture and an opportunity for San Francisco punk to really break through. And there were some great bands. I mean, bands like the Avengers, the Dead Kennedys, Code of Honor. These are, in my mind, extremely good bands. But San Francisco punk was very different than punk in the rest of the country. So you said you weren't an anarchist, but the punk here was more political. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that. In mid 1978, there's a show at the MAB, which is a fundraiser for striking coal miners in Appalachia, right?
Basically across the street from where we are right now.
Right, very close to where we are right now. But the coal that's where the show was. The coal miners were in like Ohio, Kentucky, places like that. And they weren't punks. These were like blue-collar American guys on strike. And the punks here decided to support them. You didn't see that in other cities. So there was a – they would never define themselves as, I'm an earnest progressive activist, but that's what they were doing. They did an event, No on Six, which was the bill to make it legal to fire teachers because they were gay or suspected of being gay, whatever that means.
Wow.
So they were deeply involved in politics, and this culminates in Jello Biafra's run for office, Jello Biafra being the frontman for the Dead Kennedys in 1979, where he challenges Dianne Feinstein and, of course, doesn't win, but gets 4% and forces a runoff, which for a guy who's among his proposals are we should – erect statues of Dan White. This is after the assassinations, and then raise money by selling eggs and tomatoes to throw at him. You know, he gets 4%, but he mixes in some very interesting progressive ideas that wouldn't seem out of place in like Bill de Blasio's campaigns in New York.
I was going to ask you if you sat down with Jello because you would have to.
I did a phone interview with him because it was hard to get to him.
Did he talk like this?
He didn't talk like that, but he's a great interview because you just get him started and he goes. And he started by asking me, what Mitchells are you related to? And I said,
Joni.
I said something like, well, first of all, you know, there's not that many Jewish Mitchells running around.
Yeah.
And then I said, and my brother's not alive. So I said, my mother? I mean, there's not a lot of us. And then he said, you're not related to the Attorney General, Nixon's Attorney General.
Right, I was thinking Mitchell. Watergate.
I said, no, I'm not related to John Mitchell from Watergate. He said, oh, good. Now I can talk.
It's a pretty common name,
but it's, you know, exactly.
Now, just as you mentioned Dan White, and we didn't really wrap that up, but Dan White was the guy that was disgruntled and had a screw loose and shot Moscone and Melk. And this was a highly respected guy. He was a former fireman. He was a county supervisor. And I remember the trial, the Twinkie defense, and after the verdict, there was City Hall having the glass smash. And I remember the OPD came over on buses on the Bay Bridge to help out, and it was a huge thing. And then I remember my parents were in Europe, and they go, anything happened while we were gone? And I said, Dan White killed himself. That was like the big – I mean, it was really just – I mean, the tragedies never stopped.
Dan White is – I spent a lot of time in the book, and he was the story that he was a highly respected guy is kind of is a story that his people start pushing out after the assassinations. Mm. Dan White got elected like Harvey Milk in 1977 when the city switched to district elections. So like Milk, he was on the board for less than a year. Unlike Milk, he didn't know how to be on the Board of Supervisors. So I talked to his peers, people who served with him, including people like Quentin Kopp, who were aligned with him politically, mm-hmm. who said he didn't know what he was doing.
That used to be a big name around here.
Oh, Quentin Kopp, he ran against Feinstein
for
mayor.
Sure, yeah.
And so White didn't know what he was doing. He resigned from the board because he couldn't make money. And then all the money Inter supported him said, if you needed money, why don't you just come to us? We'd have given you a consulting job. So then he goes and wants his job back. And, of course, Moscone doesn't want to give it to him. I'll just tell you one – and before we get to that, one good story that Kopp told me about Dan White because you'll like this.
Sure.
And this speaks to Moscone's personality, the differences, because Moscone was a natural politician. People like Kopp who did not like him politically, like they spoke well of him as a person. So there's a softball game in what's now Moscone Park with the Board of Supervisors on one side and the mayor and his staff on the other. This is via Quentin Kopp, this story. And he says George, meaning Mayor Moscone, is out there in center field with a cigarette in one hand, the beer down by his, you know, by his feet, the glove on the other hand, mm-hmm. like he's just having the time of his life hanging out. And he said Dan White insisted on being the manager for the supervisors team. And he said, Kopp says, he paced that dugout like it was the seventh game of the World Series, which, by the way, is
tonight.
Right? So White was very highly – was wound way too tightly, had no idea what to do with his job, and ran for the board on a very hate-filled platform. Hmm. So unite and fight with Dan White, which if you're running for fourth grade class president is a clever slogan. It doesn't really cut it in the big leagues. But also, he actually used language like, we need to eradicate malignancies that blight this city.
Wow.
That's pretty heavy stuff. And also,
Justin Herman stuff.
Yeah, but yes, exactly. But also, this is not for nothing. And this, I think, is a piece of it that's overlooked a lot. Because from where I come from, remember what I told you about, I'm told that Milk is one of us. We go back and read the history, right? Eradicate malignancies, and then you kill the highest, most visible Jewish politician in the city, right?
Yeah.
There's some really ugly – so in my view, Dan White was a bigot who wasn't very smart and got in over his head. And the prosecution bungled this not because of the Twinkie defense, but in my view because they wanted the death penalty. So they put a conservative jury because they thought they'd be pro-death penalty because they figured the conviction would be a slam dunk.
Mm-hmm.
But then the conservative jury was more open to the arguments coming from the defense side of, well, you know, he served in the military. He was a fireman. He was a cop. He was all of this. He had failed at all those things, but that didn't matter. That was a story they were telling. And then he got the light sentence. And it's pretty clear to me from reading that had he just killed Moscone, he would have gotten more time.
Yeah, that's tragic. It is. And it's hard to believe it really wasn't that long ago.
No.
Let's talk about the San Francisco Giants because my whole life, I mean, when I was 7, 8, 9, my first 3 years in Little League, the A's won the World Series every year. My cousins, diehard Giants fans, the Giants stunk. This was the first time in my life I really started to see the Giants come up and really matter. And Joe Morgan and some of these other guys and breaking Tommy Lasorda's heart. Let's talk about that season.
This is earlier than that. So if you're an A's fan, the best day of the season for the Giants fans is probably not a good one for you as a boy at the time because it's when they got Vita Blue in a trade for seven players who combined for maybe, you know, playing 100 more big league games.
By the way, and I'll throw this in, Vita Blue is my only childhood hero who I know and I can text, and that is a crazy thing. He's the best guy
ever. He's a great dude.
Fan bases love this guy.
He's a great dude, Vita Blue. But also, for the sake of this discussion, a great pitcher.
Sure.
Let's not forget that. At that time, one of the top lefties in the game, the Giants get him for nothing in spring training. And spring training, where for the first half of spring training, they were leaving town. Are they going to split their time in Oakland? Are they going to go to Denver, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
And they assemble a team. Now, I'm just a couple, you know, Vita Blue, Jack Clark, Darrell Evans, and Bill Madlock, all in the prime of their careers. None of those guys are in the Hall of Fame. You can make a decent argument. They're not really belong there, but they're definitely high-level Hall of very
good. Jack Clark, too.
Jack Clark, fantastic.
I don't know about
hitter.
Johnny LeMaster. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm not a
Chris Spire.
Chris Spire was gone. LeMaster
was now
flubbing things up at shortstop all by himself. McCovey was still playing first base most of the time. Mike Ivey hits a huge pinch hit grand slam against the Dodgers, which occurs in late May, but somehow captures the spirit of the season. They end up in first place for 3 months. If that year ends October 31st, the story in San Francisco is the Giants season. But the result of that, they drew a $1.7 million, and talk of them leaving town dies down. And I would argue that if you have Jonestown, the assassinations, and then on December 15th, Dianne Feinstein saying, Unfortunately, the Giants are moving to Denver, and there's nothing we can do about it. I think the history of this town turns out very differently.
Marvin Davis, was that the name of the guy in Denver? Because he tried to get the A's, too.
Yes.
Yeah. It was, well, I just remember Lurie tried here, and then he tried in Santa Clara County, and he tried one more time here, and he's like, screw it, I'm selling them to Tampa Bay, and that's when Bill White stepped in. This is back when we had a real commissioner and league presidents. And then it's funny, when they had to stay, Lurie was like, all right, well, I'll take $1 million off the price, and I'm still an owner.
No, he took $10
million. $10 million off, okay.
But in fairness to Bob Lurie, right, in January 1976, when George Moscone got sworn in as mayor, the day before he gets sworn in as mayor, which is like the 10th, because you don't get sworn in on the 1st here, there are headlines in the Toronto newspapers. I've read these headlines. Giants to move. Here's where, you know, predicting, can they beat out the Phillies in the National League East? It was a done deal.
Wow.
And Moscone needed to raise $8 million. You could have bought the Giants for $8 million in 1976. Nobody in the city stepped up for anything except Lurie. Lurie called right away and said, I'm in for four, and I pledge to keep him in San Francisco.
That's something that I love about the Haas family, too, because they're a San Francisco family. Yeah. But they thought it was very important to have a two-team market, and that's why they gave the Giants Santa Clara County, because they thought it was very important to keep the Giants here as well. So,
yeah, and Lurie gets a – it depends on where you – like, how, if you remember the 70s, Lurie's the hero. By the 90s, like, how many more times did this man need to get rejected by the people
of San Francisco? Well, he's sort of like Marshall Pétain, who, like, is a hero in World War I and then is a traitor in World War II.
I think Lurie did the best – that he could. Lurie, you know, it's important to note that the Lurie family is a major philanthropic family here in San Francisco, going back to Bob's father, Louis Lurie. But also, if your money is in real estate, right, and that's where they got their money, which is not a bad business to be in this town, you can't move your asset, right? Bob Lurie gets wealthier. Back, he sold his assets now. But Bob Lurie's business outside of baseball needs San Francisco to be a strong city, and a baseball team is part of that. He didn't want to take this team. He dragged that out as long as he could to keep them here and sell them to the right people.
Very interesting. I went to a wedding about 15 years ago, and Bob and his wife were at our table, and I had a great conversation with him. He seemed like a really good guy.
He is a really good dude.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a quick break, and we'll close out the hour with Lincoln A. Mitchell, the new book, San Francisco Year Zero. Come on back. I don't know. Maybe Lincoln Mitchell, you are a Rhodes Scholar.
No, I am not.
Okay, there's a little black flag there and timely. You know, we've just got a couple minutes left here. That Kennedy show at the Mabui Gardens, people were so shocked that a band would call itself that name, they tried to cancel it, right?
There was one right around Thanksgiving of 78 that they very much wanted to cancel. And the Dead Kennedys, like, the shock value of that name is hard to explain right now. You know, the Sex Pistols, that was focus group somewhere. Mm-hmm. The Dead Kennedys, it was created for the shock value, and it was at this moment, like adults then would whisper, if you were a kid, you would hear them, you know, there's a band called the Dead Kennedys.
Right.
Like, it was like this thing that was so outrageous.
It'd be like the Weinstein rape victims.
Exactly.
Oh, how dare you?
Exactly, but also because it offended the liberal sensibilities, right? The half a generation above them, the older boomers who worshipped the Kennedys, the people born in the 30s and 40s, who were good liberals and worshipped the Kennedys. And the Dead Kennedys was just so shocking. But as East Bay Ray told me, he said, I thought the assassinations were much poorer taste than the name of our band.
I love East Bay Ray. So we just got about a minute left. As a professor at Columbia, the students that we have, is this country in good hands, or are they all just fascinated with their phones?
You mean the students themselves?
Yeah.
I would take a random group of 435 undergrads today over the House of Representatives in a minute.
The book is called San Francisco Year Zero, Political Upheaval, Punk Rock, and a Third Place Baseball Team. We've been speaking with the author, Lincoln A. Mitchell, available from Rutgers University Press. And I guess you can get the e-edition?
It's a Kindle version you can get online through the usual sources. And go to your bookstore and ask them why they don't have it. If they don't, and if you read it, please rate and review it.
And then paperback coming soon?
If we sell enough hardbacks, yes.
All right. Thanks for coming in, man. I had a great first hour. Really appreciate it.
It was a lot of fun.
Especially
appreciate
a couple of locals here right around the same age. I'm Rick Tittle. We'll talk some sports on the other side. Come on back.